We're closing in on the end of this series. I only have a couple of months left, and I'm actually not kidding, but we're going to talk about Peter today, and then spend the next several weeks talking about the Apostle Paul, because if you've ever read through the book of Acts, you'll know that the Apostle Paul faced a lot of persecution, and it was pretty much continual from city to city, and we're going to look at that. We're going to look at how each time the Lord delivered him. So let's take a look at Peter. Peter was a unique individual in biblical history. I suppose everybody is for one reason or another. But Peter had a special mission that was given to him by God, and that was, it was through Peter that the door of faith was opened to the Gentiles. Prior to this, the gospel had not been preached to Gentiles. There was the rare exception of people back in the Old Testament that would be converted and join the nation of Israel. But the gospel had never gone out to Gentiles in general until Peter opened that door with the Lord's enabling. And in Acts 15 and verse 7, Peter just kind of sums this up, and it says, "And when there had been much disputing, Peter rose up and said unto them, Men and brethren, ye know how that a good while ago God made choice among us that the Gentiles by my mouth should hear the word of the gospel and believe." This was during the Jerusalem Council, and they were discussing what parts of the law of Moses, if any, the Gentiles had to be under. And Peter speaks up here and explains that it was through him that the door of faith was opened to them. And then he goes on to say that we believe that through the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, we should be saved even as they. So there's Peter saying there's no difference here between Jews and Gentiles. But the point, all I really want from this is that Peter opened that door. And Paul, when he got back from his first or second evangelistic trip, it says there in Acts 14 and verse 27, just up a few verses, it says, "And when they were come and had gathered the church together, they rehearsed all that God had done with them and how he had opened the door of faith unto the Gentiles." Now, they had walked through the door that was already open. Peter was the one that really opened it, or the Lord opened it, and Peter was the first one that stepped through it. They had experienced, though, the fullness of this as they went through all these different countries around Asia and Greece and so on and preached the gospel to Gentiles and saw the, you know, mass conversions. But it was Peter that did it. And you can read about it in Acts chapter 10 and 11. And I'm not going to go there in the interest of time. Why I bring that up is when you go to Acts chapter 12, which of course follows Acts chapter 11, in Acts chapter 11, Peter gives the account and the details of how the door was opened to him, how he went to Cornelius's house and he preached the gospel there and baptized he and his household and other people that were there and started a church. The next thing that happens to Peter after this amazing experience, this world-changing experience that God gave him, the very next thing that's recorded anyway, is that Peter gets thrown into prison after James gets killed by the sword. The very next thing. Acts 12, 1 through 4. It says, "Now about that time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church. And he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. Then were the days of unleavened bread. And when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people." He's going after the leadership. Peter, James, and John were Christ's three closest disciples. And so he kills James. Next he goes after Peter. I've mentioned this before, but this is an excellent example of how high mountains are connected with deep valleys. Because here Peter's on top of the world going and opening this door to Cornelius in his house in Acts chapter 10. And the next thing that happens is he gets put in prison. He just goes out there. He starts a church among the Gentiles. And now he's in prison. Reminds me of what Samson said in Judges 15:16. "One moment Samson's glorying, saying, heaps upon heaps with the jawbone of an ass have I slain 1,000 men. You know what the next thing he said was? He said to the Lord, "Thou hast given me great deliverance into the hand of thy servant, and now shall I die for thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised." Literally, one moment, he has a jawbone of an ass and he slays 1,000 men and he's on top of the world. The next thing out of his mouth is, "I'm going to die of thirst." High mountains, deep valleys. That's the way it happens. I can't tell you how many times, this is just a teeny little example, no big deal whatsoever, but how many times, and every preacher can attest to this, everyone that I know of, I go to church, I preach a sermon, I enjoy preaching the sermon, it's a high point, and immediately I'm depressed. I don't close the Bible before I'm depressed. I'm depressed when I go home, I'm depressed when I get home, depressed for most of the afternoon, and it happens almost every single week. Strange, I know, but it's just how it works. This is just life in this world. So Herod imprisoned Peter because he saw that it pleased the Jews that he had killed James. We saw that in Acts 12 and verse 3. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. And this just shows us the nature of politicians. That politicians will do just about anything if they think it'll score them political points with their constituents. Herod sees, hey, the Jews are happy, I just killed James. Well, I'll take Peter too, I'll make them even more happy. Ronald Reagan said something, this is one of my favorite quotes from Ronald Reagan, he had some good ones. I hope you get it, I hate to have to explain jokes. So just if you don't get it, just laugh and pretend like you got it, because explaining jokes is just really takes the fun out of it. He said, "It has been said that politics is the second oldest profession. I have learned that it bears a striking resemblance to the first." Okay, good, you got it. And I think he's right. I mean, you know, the Bible even bears that out, that the kings of the earth fornicated with Mystery Babylon, right? Anyway. Well, Pilate likewise delivered Jesus to be killed to placate the Jews. You remember that from last week, and I'm not going to read the passage there, but in Matthew 27, 20 through 26, gives the account that we just looked at last week. Pilate knew that he was innocent. Pilate clearly was having some qualms in his conscience about delivering this innocent man to be killed, but the people are crying, they want him to be crucified. And then they say, well, you know, we have no king but Caesar, and you know, you're no friend of Caesar's if you don't do this. And what did he do? He turns them over to be crucified. Politicians will do just about anything to get reelected or to not get thrown out of office. But when we see travesties of justice like this, just remember that God sees it too, and he will recompense the wicked for what they have done. Sometimes it takes a while. Sometimes it happens very quickly. You know, this same Herod that killed James with a sword, it wasn't long after this that he made an oration. And apparently he was a good speaker and had a bunch of dupes that were very impressed with him. And when he finished the oration, they said it's the voice of a God, not a man. And immediately he fell down dead and the worms ate him. So sometimes God takes care of business very quickly. We wish he'd do it that way every time, but it doesn't happen that way sometimes. But God does see it, and he will recompense. In Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 8, "If thou seest the oppression of the poor and violent perverting of judgment and justice in the province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there be higher than they." We see this all the time. Oppression, perverting of judgment and justice. I mean, just look at what's going on now. Not that it matters, but you know, they're investigating Hunter Biden now for all this malfeasance that he did, and everybody knows it. I mean, everybody knows what a scoundrel this guy was, and all the money laundering and all kinds of wicked things that he was doing. But do you think anything's going to happen? You think anything's going to result of this investigation? No, not a chance. I mean, I'd be surprised if it does. So don't be surprised by that. Marvel not at the matter, the Bible says. He that's higher than the highest regardeth. So take the highest among men, whoever that is. We don't even know who it is. It certainly is not Joe Biden. Whoever's telling him what to say, and then probably whoever's telling that guy what to say, and so on. When you get to the highest, whoever the highest is, God's higher than he is. He regards, and he will take care of business. One of these days, the Lord will recompense, and we don't ever want to try to take matters into our own hands. Romans 12 and verse 19. Romans 12, 19. It says, "Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord." You let the Lord take care of that. Now, I'm going to give you a little spoiler. Peter's in prison, and Peter gets out of prison. I'm sure you've read this account before. This is probably not new information to you. Peter will be miraculously delivered from prison. What do you think would have happened if the praying disciples, instead of having a prayer meeting like they were, and we'll see that in a minute. What would have happened if they would have said, "This is outrageous. Peter didn't do anything wrong. He shouldn't be in jail, and we're going to storm that jail, and we're going to get him out of there." What would have happened? They would have all died. They let vengeance up to the Lord, and he repaid. And that king that persecuted Peter died shortly after that. Those soldiers that persecuted Peter died very shortly after that. The Lord took vengeance. You always want to remember that. So getting back to this story here, Herod delivers Peter to four quaternions of soldiers to guard him. Turn back to Acts chapter 12 again. Acts chapter 12, verse 4. "And when he had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him." Now, a quaternion, in case you didn't know, and I didn't know either, that's why I looked it up. A quaternion, which the first part of the word should kind of tip you off as to what it is. Quat, right? Quattro, quad, right? Four. It is a group or set of four persons or things. And a soldier is one who serves in an army for pay, one who takes part in military service or warfare, a man of military skill and experience. So therefore, Peter was guarded by 16 highly trained and heavily armed men. So there's no humanly possible way that Peter could have escaped this prison. You take 16 highly trained and armed soldiers that are guarding you, and unless you're some kind of a Superman, you are not getting out of there. It would be completely impossible. Well, Herod intends to bring him forth after Easter to the people. That's what it says there in the second half of that verse. Intending after Easter to bring him forth to the people. Now, there are people that will take issue with this verse and say that this is an error in the King James Bible because it uses the word Easter, and Easter is a pagan celebration, and it wasn't around back then, and so on. That this was an error, that Easter should not be in here. But this is not an error. The word Easter is just another word for the Passover. It's not a corruption in the King James Bible. I'll give you the definition out of the OED. Of course, the first definition is the pagan fertility festival that supposedly honors the resurrection of Christ. Definition number two is the Jewish Passover, and it cites this very verse as an example of that usage. Acts 12 and verse 4. It's not just the King James Bible that used the word Easter to refer to the Passover in the Scripture. There are also people that say that I'll get back to that point in a second. There are also people that say that this is actually referring to the pagan fertility festival, Easter, and that Herod was involved in that or something. And they use the reasoning there that it says that these are the days of unleavened bread, and after Easter he's going to let him out, and the Passover was the first day of unleavened bread. So they're saying, you know, that the Passover was already over. This isn't referring to the Passover, it's referring to the pagan feast. But the days of unleavened bread are that the Passover encompasses all that. the days of unleavened are about the Passover. So when it says those are the days of unleavened bread, I take that as that those days are upon them. This is coming right up, and he's going to release him after the Passover, after the days of unleavened bread, after the whole thing is over, then he's going to release him. And my reason for this is that in previous English Bibles, this is just one reason, is they use the word Easter numerous times to refer to the Passover. And I have them quoted here for you. This shows us, among other things, just a very simple thing, this shows us how much the English language has changed since the 1500s, because I'll bet you if you tried to read this and you didn't know what, you didn't have a general idea of what it was already saying, you wouldn't even be able to read it with the spelling and everything. This is from the Bishop's Bible in 1568, John 11:55. It says, "And the Jews," the I's and J's used to be reversed, "and the Jews, Easter, was nigh at hand." Go look it up in John 11:55. It's the Passover was nigh at hand. "And the Jews' Easter was nigh at hand, and many went out of the country up," see, V's and U's were reversed as well, "up to," that's Jerusalem, believe it or not, that Hierusal, "before the Easter," there it is again, "before the Passover, to purify themselves." In the Coverdale Bible, likewise, in Ezekiel 45 and verse 21, "upon," now ye is an old word for the, right? "Upon the 14th day of the first month, ye shall keep Easter." Go look it up. It's the Passover, right? So they were, obviously, back in the Old Testament, he wasn't using Easter to refer to the pagan fertility feast. Clearly not, right? That word was used to refer to the Passover. Tyndale's Bible, 1534. "Purge therefore the old leaven, that ye may be new dough, as ye are sweet bread. For Christ our Easter lamb is offered up for us." Easter lamb means Passover, Passover lamb. That's, if you look up that passage, you know that Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. And I have it. It says Tyndale Bible there. That was a copy and paste error. It's the Coverdale Bible of 1535. In that same passage, it renders it, "Purge out therefore the old leaven, that ye may be a new dough, like as ye are sweet bread. For we also have an Easter lamb, which is Christ, that is offered for us." It says Passover in the King James, "Christ our Passover." And then one more, actually the same passage. This is out of the Matthew's Bible in 1549, "For Christ our Easter lamb is offered up for us." So I think I've made a pretty good case that this was not some corruption in the King James Bible. They weren't referring to the pagan fertility fest. It's just referring to the Passover. That's all. After the Passover and the days of unleavened bread, which were all part of that celebration, Herod was going to deliver Peter up to the Jews. Herod had no qualms about leaving a man of God to suffer in prison in order to not disrupt a national holiday being celebrated by his persecutors. Think about that. Here his persecutors are persecuting him, and Herod leaves him in prison just so it doesn't disrupt their holiday, so they can have a good time and not have to worry about dealing with this pesky Christian. But this situation was quite ironic if you think about it, because the Jews were celebrating the Passover, which was a type and shadow of Jesus Christ, who was the fulfillment of what the Passover typified. Okay, so the Passover and the Passover lamb that was sacrificed and the blood was covered on the doorpost and the lintel, that was a picture of Christ, which is completely obvious to anybody, right? That Passover lamb and the Passover feast represented and pictured ahead of time, it figured, Jesus Christ dying for the sins of his people and covering them with his blood. And because of that, they were passed over. The wrath of God passed over them and they weren't judged. Okay, that's what the Passover typified. Now, the irony here is the man who was preaching to them about the Lamb of God, whom their Passover celebration pointed to, was put in prison for their pleasure during that celebration. They are celebrating what Jesus Christ is the figure of, or the antitype of, Peter is preaching to them about the Lamb of God, who is the Passover. He is their Passover. And they put him in prison during that time to celebrate the Passover. Think about that. I mean, think about the irony of that. Well, while Peter was kept in prison, it says in Acts 12 and verse 5 that prayer was made without ceasing of the church unto God for him. Verse 5, Peter therefore was kept in prison, but prayer was made without ceasing unto the church of God, unto the church unto God for him. They were doing what it says in 1 Thessalonians 5:17, pray without ceasing. One of the shortest verses in the Bible. And God honors diligent, continual, faith-filled prayers which are made with importunity. I'm going to give you two examples. The first one is in Luke chapter 18. And this example here with Peter would be the third example. These Christians were putting into practice what Jesus had taught them by way of these parables or stories. They might not have even been parables. They might have just been teachings. Luke 18, 1 through 8. Well, this is definitely a parable. And he spake a parable unto them, to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint, saying, there was in a city a judge which feared not God, neither regarded man. And there was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, avenge me of mine adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God nor regard man. It's funny, he even admits it to himself. Yet, because this widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual wearying, she weary me. He thinks to himself, I don't fear God, I don't regard men, I don't care about this widow, but she's driving me crazy. She just keeps coming, and she's just going to make me go mad, so I'm just going to give her what she wants, because I'm tired of hearing her. And the Lord said, hear what the unjust judge saith. In other words, pay attention. You see how the unjust judge is going to react to somebody that just keeps coming and keeps asking? The unjust judge is going to give the person what she wants. And shall not God avenge his own elect, which cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? It's a rhetorical question. Shall not God avenge his own elect? Yes, he will. Though they bear long, they cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them. So God allows us to cry unto him repeatedly, day after day sometimes, for petitions that we have. He doesn't answer them immediately. Sometimes he does, but a lot of times he doesn't. But it says he'll avenge them speedily. When he avenges them, he does so speedily. It's like when Jesus said, I come quickly. He didn't mean I was coming when the ink dried on the book of Revelation. He didn't mean he was coming the next day. But when he does come, it's quick. It's fast. It's when nobody's expecting it. And all of a sudden he comes suddenly. And he judges. And he delivers his people. This is what God does. He lets us cry unto him day and night. And then when he is ready, the deliverance comes suddenly. Turn back to Luke chapter 11, verses 1 through 10. So don't just think, oh, I prayed about it one time and I didn't get my answer, so I'm going to stop praying. Well, that's not how God works. So, I mean, I suppose, I'm sure there's times when God answers a prayer that's made once. But a lot of times, and most Christians, probably all Christians can attest to this, that sometimes prayers are made over and over again for years before they're finally answered. Luke 11, 1 through 10. And it came to pass that as he was praying in a certain place, when he ceased, see, when it says pray without ceasing, it doesn't mean that you never stop praying. You pray 24 hours a day. Of course, you know, you have to eat, you have to sleep, you have to work, you have to, right? So it's not talking about praying just one unending prayer for 70 years of your life where you never stop, right? It's talking about praying in every situation, continually, regularly, right? That's what praying without ceasing is. Obviously, Jesus ceased, and he's not breaking his own commandment. One of his disciples said unto him, Lord, teach us to pray, as John also taught his disciples. And he said unto them, When ye pray, say, Our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, as in heaven, so in earth. Give us day by day our daily bread, and forgive us our sins, for we also forgive every one that is indebted to us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And he said unto them, Which of you shall have a friend? Now he's going to give them an illustration of how you ought to pray. Which of you shall have a friend, and shall go unto him at midnight, and say unto him, Friend, lend me 3 loaves. For a friend of mine in his journey is come to me, and I have nothing to set before him. And he from within shall answer and say, Trouble me not, the door is now shut, and my children are with me in bed. I cannot rise and give thee. I totally understand this. If one of you came beating at my door at midnight asking me for a loaf of bread, I would tell you to go away. I'm sleeping. Your lack of planning, it's not an emergency on my part. But this guy was in a tough way. He says, I say unto you, wait a second here. Yeah, verse 8, I say unto you, though he will not rise and give him because he is his friend. See, friendship only goes so far. Getting up at midnight to give a loaf of bread is just a step too far for most people's friendship. Yet because of his importunity, he will rise and give him as many as he needeth. Importunity is troublesome pertinacity and solicitation. That means the guy just keeps beating on the door. Come on, man, I really need a loaf of bread. No, I'm sleeping. Go away. Boom, boom, boom. Come on, I need some bread. Just give me some bread. I got somebody here at my house. No, go away. Boom, boom, boom. Fine, take the bread. Get out of here, right? That's what you call importunity. And they're friends, so it's not going to matter the next day. You know, they're going to laugh it off and, you know, whatever. He's not going to be mad anymore. You wouldn't do that to just some stranger, but you'd do it to your friend. I mean, I wouldn't have a problem beating on your door at midnight if I needed a loaf of bread, right? Even though I told you I wouldn't do it for you, I wouldn't have a problem doing that if I had somebody come by, they were hungry. Now, how especially important is it for us to pray fervently for our brethren when they are going through a hard time? Right, this guy just needed some bread. Right? But how important is it to use importunity, troublesome pertinacity and solicitation, and just continue to ask God to deliver your friend who's in prison? God answers prayers that are made like that, and we're going to see that as we go through this. Well, back in Acts chapter 12, the night came that Herod planned to bring Peter out of prison. Now, I would say that Herod is most likely taking Peter out of prison to execute him. I doubt he's just going to release him after keeping him. He kept him there until after the Passover. He wanted to bring him forth and deliver him to the Jews, probably to execute him. Because he saw it did them, the Jews were happy that he killed James, so I assume that's what he was going to do to Peter as well. And I don't think that's probably too far out in left field for an assumption. Verse 6, Acts 12 and verse 6. And when Herod would have brought him forth, the same night Peter was sleeping between 2 soldiers bound with 2 chains, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. So Herod would have brought him forth. He's intending to bring him forth that night. So you talk about an 11th hour deliverance here. Herod is just ready to give the order to send somebody down to the prison that very night. Peter's there sleeping. If the Lord would have tarried but maybe another hour or so, Peter would have been dead. They would have taken him out of there and killed him, just like they did James. But that night, Peter's sleeping between 2 soldiers, bound with 2 chains. And just a little practical lesson, this tells me that even in life's most trying times, the Lord giveth his beloved sleep. You remember Acts 1:27 and verse 2? Acts 1:27. Did I say the wrong? Acts, you guys didn't know there's 127 chapters in the book of Acts? Psalm 1:27 and verse 2. I wish there were 127 chapters in Acts, because there's a whole lot of information that I would have liked to have known that happened after Acts ends, because it just kind of ends there with Paul in his hired house and doesn't even tell us what happened to him. Anyway, Psalm 127 in verse 2 says, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep." Now, whether you take the opportunity or not is another story. Some people are dumb enough to not take it. It's vain to rise up early and to sit up late. It's stupid to deprive yourself of sleep. God will give it to you if you're just smart enough to make life choices so that you can get some sleep. You know, it says in Psalm 4 in verse 8, "I will both lay me down in peace and sleep, for thou, Lord, only makest me dwell in safety." Peter was safe in the prison, wasn't he? He laid his head down in peace and slept. The Lord gave him that sleep. Well, the angel of the Lord appears in the prison and he wakes Peter up and he tells him to get up. And at the same moment, his chains fall off. This is miraculous, is it not? Acts 12 and verse 7 says, "And behold, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison, and he smote Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, Arise up quickly. And his chains fell off from his hands." Reminds me of that hymns. My chains fell off, my heart was moved, I rose, stood up, and followed thee, or something. You don't know that song? Oh my. That's very sad. What is that song? It'll come to me. Remind me about it. I'll show it to you. I think it's in our hymnal. We need to learn that one if you don't know it. But anyway, so the angel comes in there, tells him to get up, and immediately the chains just fall off. The Lord is certainly not hindered by chains of iron or anything else. Nothing that you could think of is going to stop him from doing what he wants to do. This is the second time that Peter would be delivered from prison by God using an angel. You turn back to Acts chapter 5, verses 17 through 20. The Lord had already done this to Peter. And it's interesting here that Peter thinks this is a vision. We'll get into that in a second. But he's already experienced it once, and yet he still doesn't think it's real when it happens the second time, which is, just shows the weakness of man. In Acts 5:17 through 20, it says, "Then the high priest rose up, and all they that were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and were filled with indignation, and laid their hands on the apostles, and put them in the common prison. But the angel of the Lord by night opened the prison doors and brought them forth and said, Go stand and speak in the temple to the people all the words of this life." I could have included this, I guess, in this series. It was a fairly short episode here. But once again, they were put in prison. The angel comes and opens the doors. And he doesn't say, okay, now get in a ship and go to another country. Flee for asylum. Go hide in your house. Be afraid. He says, go right back to where you were before and start preaching. Go right back to the temple, right out in the open, and start preaching again. Just remember that. Remember that. Whatever, come what may, that's our marching orders. Just keep doing what we've always done. This just shows us an example of how God has assigned angels to protect and watch over each of his children. You know, it says it of the little children, and I assume from these other verses that I'm going to give you after this, that this applies to big kids too, like you and I. You and me. You and me. I'm the object. Me is objective. Yeah. You and me. So you're getting an English lesson today. Matthew 18 and verse 10. Matthew 18 and verse 10, "Take heed that ye despise not one of these little ones. For I say unto you that in heaven their angels do always behold the face of my Father which is in heaven." It says their angels. Like these little ones have angels, or at least each of them has an angel. They collectively have angels, and they're called their angels. He didn't say God's angels. He says their angels. Those angels are assigned to those little ones. And woe unto the man that offends one of these little ones, Jesus said, that believe in him. In verse 6, it'd be better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he were cast into the depth of the sea. You don't want to offend a little believer in Jesus Christ, like by teaching him evolution and teaching him that God's not real and things like that. I feel bad for these teachers that are doing that. They may find a millstone around their neck one of these days. But I'll show you why I think this is for big kids, not just little kids as well. Because in Psalm 91, verses 11 and 12, the Lord says that he gives his angels charge over us to keep us. Psalm 91, 11 and 12. For he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee in all thy ways, lest they shall bear thee up in their hands, lest thou dash thy foot against a stone. So this tells me that God dispenses angels to protect us in our lives from things. And I wouldn't doubt that I've been protected by angels in the past. I've never seen one or anything like that. But I think of all the times that I could have been killed, especially as a teenager and driving at high rates of speed and doing all kinds of insane things. I could have easily died many times over. And I wouldn't be surprised if there was an angel guarding and protecting me, because the Lord had plans for my life that he wasn't going to allow me to snuff out early by being a fool. Turn to Hebrews 1 and verse 14. Hebrews 1 and verse 14. I'll just give you one more example here about how angels are given to minister to us. It says, are not they, this is referring to God's angels. You can read the previous verse and the several verses prior to that. Are they not all ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who shall be heirs of salvation? They're ministering for us. We're the heirs of salvation. So yes, I believe that God has assigned angels to protect his children on this earth. I don't think that's just some fable that people believe. Well, the angel told Peter to get his clothes on and his shoes on and to follow him, Acts 12 and verse 8. Acts 12 and verse 8, and the angel said unto him, gird thyself and bind on thy sandals. And so he did. And he saith unto him, cast thy garment about thee and follow me. So get your, gird up yourself, get your clothes on, get your shoes on, and follow me, he says. Well, Peter did as he was told, even though he didn't think it was actually happening. Peter thinks that he's seeing a vision. He doesn't even think this is real. This is like some kind of a dream. But in his dream, he's doing what the angel said. He thinks it's a dream anyway. Just like one of those things where I just can't believe this is happening. This must be some kind of a vision. Verse 9. And he went out and followed him and wist not. That means he knew not that it was true which was done by the angel, but thought he saw a vision. He didn't realize it was true, like it's actually happening in reality. He thought that this must be some kind of a dream. Well, they just walked right out of the prison with no resistance from the guards whatsoever, and then the angel left him. Now, the angel was just there for the time that he was needed, and then he was off to probably take care of somebody else. In verse 10, when they were past the first and the second ward, they came unto the iron gate that leadeth unto the city, which opened to them of his own accord. And they went out and passed on through one street, and forthwith the angel departed from him. They just walked right past the guards. They were probably all asleep by the power of God. And they come to this big iron gate, and it just opens right up, and out he goes. God could do that today. I mean, maybe you're not going to have a physical iron gate that's just opening up of his own accord. But you know what? You could end up in prison, and some higher up somewhere sends the message, let him go, and guess what? You walk right out past all those guards, that door opens up right in front of you, and boom, you're free. God could do the same thing today, very easily. Well, when Peter came to himself, he was then certain that God has sent his angel and delivered him out of the hand of Herod and the Jews. Verse 11. And when Peter was come to himself, he said, Now I know of a surety that the Lord hath sent his angel and hath delivered me out of the hand of Herod and from the expectation of the people of the Jews. This is why I say I think Herod was going to kill him. He delivered him out of the hand of Herod. Right? If Herod was just going to let him go, well, God wouldn't have had to do that, right? Obviously, Herod had some designs, and the Jews had some designs for Peter, and the Lord thwarted that. Now, I've always thought this is interesting, always, for a long time anyway, that this is a picture of salvation. God saves us from prison and death by his grace and power, right? You think about this, spiritually speaking, right? We were in the devil's prison, right? Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free, right? So we're in the devil's prison, and God delivers us from prison by his grace and power. And it's only after that we've been saved that we can know and understand what the Lord did for us. It's only after you've been saved that you can know that God chose you before the foundation of the world. It's only after you've been saved and regenerated that you can know that Jesus Christ died for your sins and believe that, right? Those things come afterwards. God does the saving first, and you learn about it after the fact, and you can look back on it with clarity and understand what happened to you after the fact. This is the same thing that happened to Peter. God delivered him, and Peter didn't even realize what was going on until after he's already out and then looks back and says, oh, well, the Lord sent his angel. But he didn't know it at the time. Now, as soon as Peter was freed from prison, the first place he went was the place where the church was gathered. This is powerful. You think about this. He gets out of prison, and the first place he goes is to church, where people were gathered praying for him, assembled together as saints. Very first place. Verse 12. And when he had considered the thing, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. Now, this is not the first time that Peter, being let go, went to his own company. He did this also in Acts chapter 4. In verse 23. Acts chapter 4 and verse 23. The implications of this to me are very powerful. Acts chapter 4 and verse 23. And being let go, they went to their own company and reported all that the chief priests and elders had said unto them. As soon as they were let go, they didn't go running and hiding, and they were afraid, and they were going to not show their faces around there anymore. They went to their own company. The very people that they'd be likely to be persecuted with again, that's where they went. And the first place that we should desire to go to when we are freed is to the church of God to worship with the brethren. That's the first place we should desire to go. Now, there's two applications to this. There's a spiritual application, and there is a natural application. This applies to when we're freed from sin and false doctrine when we're first converted. The person that first finds out that they're a sinner, first comes to the realization that they're a sinner, and that Jesus Christ died for their sins, the first place they ought to go when they find out what God did for them is to the church, to be baptized, to be joined unto Christ's people. Because they're being freed from prison. You're being freed from a prison of sin and from a prison of false doctrine. When you get freed from that prison of lies and of sin, the first place you ought to go is God's church. That's what Peter did. But of course, it also applies naturally to being freed from prison when persecuted. If I'm ever put in prison, and I may be, if I ever am and I get released, and I hope I do, the first place I want to go is here. I want to go where the saints are assembled. Now, this tells us a lot about Peter's character and priorities. Peter didn't avoid the church in an attempt to avoid future persecution. There's a lot of people that if they got put in jail, maybe, most people that get put in jail for their faith are serious about their faith, so you don't have a whole lot of, you know, weak type Christians that are going to get put in jail. They would have bailed long before that. But there would be some people that would be put in jail, and the last place they want to go is back to church. Because that's the place where I'm going to get in trouble again. That's the place where I'm going to get apprehended again. I'm going to stay away from that place. But Peter didn't avoid the church. He went right back to it. And I think about that girl in that book, The Persecutor, that I was telling you about that I just finished reading this past week. And there was a girl in there named Natasha, and they came into a meeting where this girl was assembled with a dozen other or so believers. And this big dude, not Sergey, I just found that out. Sergey, it wasn't Sergey Kordakov, it was one of his friends. And he picks this girl up the whole way above his head, like this, and held her up there for a time, I don't know, multiple seconds. You know, it wasn't just like pick her up and throw her, pick her up, held her up there as she pleaded with him not to hurt her, and then threw her with all his force straight against the wall. She hit the wall at the same exact level that he threw her from. So, I mean, a hard throw, smashed against the wall and falls down and just lays there. They taught her a lesson, they thought. He goes out on the next raid. And who do you think he finds in that raid but Natasha? Same girl, and there she is again. He says, I'll teach her a lesson this time. And they stripped that girl down of all her clothes and laid her on her stomach. And he started to beat her with his open hand. And he said it was hurting his hand, like just slapping her over and over again. And this is a strong young man that has a lot of endurance. And he beat her and beat her until he literally could not swing his arm anymore. And she started to blister and bruise and bleed. And he had chunks of her flesh clinging to his hand as he continued to beat her. And she eventually gave in. She was lying there, biting her bottom lip, trying not to scream out and cry, and she bit the whole way through her lip, blood running down her face, and then she finally starts crying because she couldn't take it anymore. The next raid, when he goes back to a different church meeting, guess who's there? Natasha. And some other guy was about ready to hit her over the head with a club and probably kill her. And one of the other reprobates stepped in and stopped him and said, no, and basically threatened him, I'm going to kill you if you touch her. He said, she's got something. She's got something that we don't. And they didn't do anything to her that time. And that was after, by the way, after the second time when he beat her so badly, then he called her into the police station to intimidate her, to tell her that you better stay away from these people or it's going to be worse the next time. And it was after that time that they found her there a third time. That's a woman of faith. Back to Peter. He didn't avoid church, and he didn't also go to visit his family first. You know, Peter was married. Probably had children. He had a mother. His wife's mother was sick. He had family. And where's the first place he went? Church. Now, maybe his family was there. Maybe his wife was a believer. I don't know. But he didn't go back to the family. He went to where the saints were. His first thought was to go to be with the brethren. What brethren do out of desire, not out of compulsion, tells me a lot about their zeal for the Lord and His truth. What brethren do out of desire, not of compulsion, tells me a lot about their zeal for the Lord and His truth. I should never have to force someone to go to church. God forbid I have to force any member of this church, resident or non-resident, to come to church. I shouldn't have to force anybody. I shouldn't have to remind people to go to church, hound them about it. You should want to be here. I'm going to read you a very powerful quote from A.W. Tozer. He said, every normal man has a company, unquote, quote unquote. however small, where he feels at home, and to which he will return when he is tired of being alone. The important thing about a man is not where he goes when he is compelled to go, but where he goes when he is free to go where he will. The apostles went to jail, and that is not too revealing because they went there against their will. But when they got out of jail and could go where they would, they immediately went to the praying company. From this we learn a great deal about them. The choices of life, not the compulsions, reveal character. A man is absent from church Sunday morning. Where is he? If he is in the hospital having his appendix removed, his absence tells us nothing about him except that he is ill. But if he is out on the golf course, that tells us a lot. To go to the hospital is compulsory. To go to the golf course, voluntary. The man is free to choose, and he chooses to play instead of to pray. His choice reveals what kind of man he is. Choices always do. That's powerful. That's why I'm not very impressed with people, even people that have done great things and endured great things, if you have to. Because if you have to endure it, well, that's great. I mean, you made it. But people that do and endure things that they don't have to because they made decisions to do difficult things that don't feel good, but they do them anyway, that's impressive to me. That's impressive. Well, Peter knocked on the door when he gets to the company of the saints here, and a young girl named Rhoda went to the door and heard Peter's voice, but she's too excited to let him in, and instead she went and told the others. This is kind of comical if you think about it. Acts 12:13-14. And Peter knocked at the door of the gate, and as Peter knocked at the door of the gate, a damsel, which is a young girl, came to hearken, named Rhoda. And when she knew Peter's voice, she opened not the gate for gladness, but ran in and told Peter, and told how Peter stood before the gate. This is just like the time when the disciples first saw Christ raised from the dead, and it says they believed not for joy. She was so overwhelmed with her emotions, she was so excited that she doesn't even let him in, and she runs back and lets everybody else know. Peter's out there knocking and says, hey, it's me. She's like, it's Peter. And she runs off and tells them, hey, Peter's here. She forgets to even open the door. See, her emotions are stopping her from thinking straight. You always never let your emotions control you. Happy emotions or sad emotions. A lot of people are led by their hearts. They do things based on how they feel. You don't want to do that. Do things based on logic and reason, sound thinking, not on your emotions and how you feel. Well, when she goes to tell the praying believers here that it's Peter, they don't believe her and they think she's crazy. They tell her she's nuts. Verse 15, they say unto her, thou art mad, which means crazy. You're insane. But she constantly affirmed that it was even so. Then said they, it is his angel. She says, hey, Peter's here. And they're like, oh, you're crazy. He's not here. No, really, it's Peter. He's there. I heard his voice. They're like, oh, no, it's his angel. Meanwhile, Peter's out there, boom, 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 boom. I mean, the angel is out there knocking at the door. And they're like, oh, it's his angel. You know, don't let him in. Well, even if it is his angel, why don't you let him in? You know, boom, 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 let me in. People are funny, you know. Now, here's the interesting thing. Although they had been praying for Peter's release from prison, when it actually happened, they didn't believe it. Here they are praying for him to be released from prison, and he gets released, and they don't believe that it actually happened. Which tells me they probably didn't believe, or didn't fully believe, that God was able to even do it. Think about that. I mean, if you're praying and you really believe that God is able and that he will answer the prayer if he wants to, and then all of a sudden the prayer gets answered, you're like, oh, no, that's his angel. You're crazy. Well, this tells me that God is merciful to our human weakness and sometimes answers the prayers of those who are weak in faith. Now, if you want to get your prayers answered, you're a lot better off to be strong in faith and believe what you pray for. Jesus said, whatsoever you ask, believing ye shall receive. But the Lord knoweth our frame. He knoweth that we are dust. He knows that we are but flesh, and he is merciful to us. But I still, of course, exhort you to pray in faith. Believe what you're asking for. Believe that God will give it to you is what I mean, if it's his will. But Peter just kept on knocking. Verse 16, but Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened the door and saw him, they were astonished. Astonished. Think about that. I'll give you that definition here in just a second. This is just a good reminder just to keep knocking until the door is open. Ask and it shall be given, seek and ye shall find, knock and the door shall be open unto you, for everyone that asketh receiveth, and everyone that seeketh findeth, and everyone that knocks to him shall be opened. Right? Matthew 7, 7 through 8. Can you imagine if Peter went and knocked on the door, and she's like, oh, it's Peter, and she runs back, they're like, no, it's his angel, and Peter's like, well, I guess, what can I do, and he just goes home. Of course not, you keep knocking, right? Keep knocking until the door opens. Persistence pays. Peter just kept knocking. But when they finally let him in, it says they were astonished there in verse 16. Astonished means bereft of sensation, stunned, benumbed, stunned or paralyzed mentally, bereft of one's wits, stupefied, bewildered. These men who had been praying for Peter to be released, when he actually gets released and they see him, it's as if they are just, they can't believe it. Stunned, shocked, paralyzed, just like in a state of shock. Why? They've been praying that God will release them, and when God actually does, they just can't even believe it. It's just funny. I mean, it's just people, right? We're just flesh. We're but dust. We're but flesh. We're flesh and but. We're dust and but flesh. Sometimes people get those things mixed up, those two verses. If they would have believed that God was going to deliver him, or at least that God could deliver him at any time, they would not have been stunned when he did. Think about that. If they would have really had the faith, they would have been expecting a knock on the door at any time, not doubting it when it happened. Well, Peter told them how God had delivered him out of the prison, verse 17. But he, beckoning unto them with the hand to hold their peace, declared unto them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, go, show these things unto James and to the brethren. And he departed and went into another place. Well, when Herod finds out what happened to Peter, that he was escaped, he commands that these soldiers be put to death. Verses 18 and 19. Now, as soon as it was day, there was no small stir among the soldiers. What was become of Peter? You can imagine, they got 16 of them, and they were probably all in a cell with him or something, or standing outside the cell, and they're all looking around like, where is he? How could he have gotten out of here? This is impossible. And they're probably scared. And I wouldn't blame them. If I was them, I would have been scared too. And when Herod had sought for him and found him not, he examined the keepers and commanded that they should be put to death. And he went down from Judea to Caesarea and there abode. Now this should be a lesson to anyone who takes part in the persecution of God's people. This would be a good one for cops, police officers, or CYS. Agents, I don't know if they call it CYS here, Children and Youth Services, right? The people that like to take kids away from Christians. It's mostly probably a lot of Christians that they take them away from or want to and probably will in the future. Police, government agents, people like that, anybody that goes along with the persecution of Christians, prison guards, all that, you better beware. You better be careful. Because I was just doing my job doesn't cut it with God. These soldiers were killed because Peter got away. But you know why I think they were killed? Because they persecuted a man of God. You say, well, that would have cost them their job if they would have said no. So, is a job worth going against God persecuting God's people. Oh, it's my job. I've got a retirement with the police department. I can't. Well, okay. Do what you want, but I don't want to be you. Now, there are some lessons we can learn from this. Lesson number one, even the greatest of the saints will face persecution. You realize that Peter was at the top of the heap, him and Paul together. It was Peter that Jesus said, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock will I build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. And unto thee will I give the keys of the kingdom of heaven. And whatsoever thou shalt bind on earth shall be bound, and whatsoever thou shalt loose on earth shall be loosed." Pretty close paraphrase anyway. Peter wasn't the rock Christ built the church on. Christ was the rock. But Christ gave Peter the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Giving somebody the keys to something is giving them the authority. Peter was given the authority in the church. So he's probably one of Christ's three favorite apostles. No doubt about that. If he can face persecution, why wouldn't you or I? Lesson number two. Expect trials and tribulations after God gives you great blessings. I've told you this before, I think. But when things are going really well in my life, I start to look over my shoulder and wonder what's going to happen next. Because usually, good times are followed by bad times. But then again, when things are going really badly, I can also expect things to start going better, too. That's just how it works. See, most preachers, when I talk to them, "How are things going? How's your church going?" "Well, good so far." Usually, everything's going wonderful. Wonderfully. If everything's going wonderfully, everybody starts to get a little nervous. Lesson number three. The powers that be will persecute us just to please those who have influence over them. You know, would it be beyond a government official to persecute people because his donors or the people that are made sure that he got into office or that he's going to stay in office because they don't like these certain people? Of course not. Remember Ahasuerus with Haman, and Haman comes to him and says, "Hey, there are these people, you know, they got different customs, and you know, we need to get rid of them." He's like, "Oh yeah, go ahead." He didn't care. Somebody comes up to him and wants to persecute Christians, you know, that can happen. But remember also, there's a God in heaven, and he doesn't often let that happen, and we can thank him for it. Lesson number four. It is often people who claim to be God's people who are our most troublesome persecutors. We've seen this before. We've seen this with Jesus Christ. Who persecuted him? Pilate and Herod weren't coming after him, or not very much. I mean, they said Herod would kill thee. But who were the ones that were persecuting him the most? The Jews. The Christians of the day, right? The believers of the day. Who have I got? I've said this before. I know I'm repeating myself. Sound like an old man. Who have I received the most trouble from in my life? Christians, quote unquote. Lesson number five. God can deliver us out of a situation which seems humanly impossible. You could be guarded in a cell by 16 well-armed and skilled soldiers. And the Lord could deliver you just like he did Peter. You say, "Well, how is that possible?" We haven't been listening to this series for the last year, apparently. It's very easily possible. God could do that as easy as he could flick a booger off his finger. I mean, it'd just be nothing for God to do that. Lesson number six. God hears and answers the prayers of his faithful people, which they make for persecuted saints, and even some less than faithful people. here are the people praying for Peter. I know I'm being hard on them, but this just kind of dawned on me. Here are these people praying for Peter, and they don't even believe it when the deliverance happens. They just can't believe it. It's like they didn't expect it to happen almost, because if you expected it to happen, you wouldn't be surprised when it happened. When's the last time you were ever surprised by something you expected to happen? You ever wake up in the morning and look out the window and say, "Whoa, what is that? The sun, I mean, it's coming up. Whew. Shocking. I've never been shocked by the sun coming up. I expect it to, right?" Why were they so shocked? That's what I want to know. I think it's because they didn't have as much faith as they should have. You say easy for you to say. Well, you know, maybe it is easier for me to say, but I mean, it is. It's a fact. I'm not saying I'd have done any better. I'm just saying they could have had and should have had more faith, but God was merciful anyway. Lesson number 7. The Lord will often wait until the 11th hour to deliver us to try our faith. Like I said, it was the very night that Herod was going to get Peter out of the prison. And I don't think it was to send him on his merry way, like I said. The very night that Peter was going to be put to death, I think, is the time, just shortly before that the Lord delivered him. Because if the Lord would have delivered him before he would have ever gone to prison, what would that have done for Peter's faith? What would that have done for the people that were praying for him? What would it have done for their faith? Not a whole lot. But when he delivered them in the 11th hour, that'll have an impression. Lesson number 8. God uses angels to deliver us from trouble, and we often don't even realize it. Peter didn't even know it. He thought it was a vision. He thought he was dreaming. He thought he was just hallucinating or something. But yet, after it happened, he realized, oh, that was an angel. Same thing can happen to you. I'm pretty certain it's happened to me, though I couldn't prove it, but I do think that. Lesson number 9. If we are in prison or forced to be away from church, the first place we should desire to go once freed is back to church to be with the people of God. God forbid somebody would go to prison and we'd never see him again. We'd hear, hey, so-and-so, brother so-and-so got out of prison and he never shows up again. That'd be really sad. I mean, how sad would it be to have a man that was put in prison for his faith, delivered from prison, and then we have to exclude him for forsaking the assembly afterwards? Think about that. That'd be horribly sad. First place we ought to go is back to the church. And that goes with any great tribulation. Because I've seen this happen too with people. I've seen spouses die, and then, and not in the church that I pastored, but I've seen this happen out there among people that I know in the world. The spouse dies, the person's a professing Christian, that spouse dies, and she doesn't want to go back to church. She's mad at God or whatever. You don't ever want to go there. Lesson number 10. God is merciful to his children who are weak in faith and will sometimes hear their prayers for deliverance despite their spiritual weakness. Just like those people that were praying for Peter. And the last one, lesson number 11. Those who persecute the saints will be judged by God for it in due time. They'll get what's coming to them. I'll just give you one verse to close with. In 2 Thessalonians, in chapter 1, if it doesn't happen in this life like it did to those soldiers, it'll happen to them at the second coming. He says there in verse, well, I'll just start in verse 4. So that we ourselves glory in you in the churches of God for your patience and faith in all your persecutions and tribulations which ye endure, which is a manifest token of the righteous judgment of God, that ye may be counted worthy of the kingdom of God for which ye also suffer. If you suffer persecution and tribulation, it's a manifest token of the judgment of God against your persecutors and God's judgment that you are one of his faithful children. seeing it as a righteous thing with God to recompense tribulation to them that trouble you. And to you who are troubled, rest with us when the Lord Jesus shall be revealed from heaven with his mighty angels in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of his power, when he shall come to be glorified in his saints and to be admired in all them that believe, because our testimony among you was believed in that day. When Christ comes back, we will be honored, and our persecutors will be cast into hell if they're not God's children, and they will get what's coming to them eventually, whether in this life or in the next. Next time we're going to pick up and we're going to talk about the Apostle Paul, and we're going to walk through a lot of the book of Acts. Not the whole thing, I'm not going to go through it verse by verse, but we're going to go through all the sections which deal with Paul being persecuted and then being delivered, Lord willing.
Just a quick note at the end of the sermon. The most important thing a believer in Jesus Christ can do is to be a member of one of God's true churches. If you're not already a member of one, go to pastorwagner.com/churches to see if there is a true church or other believers of like faith near you. That's pastorwagner.com/churches.